everybody. Welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 46. My name is Alex Ford, subbing in for our usual hosts, Brandon and Charles, today. We have an awesome episode. We have a really special treat for you. Co-creator of Ember, Yehuda Katz, is joining us today. Hello, Yehuda.
Heyo.
We also have a first-time Frontside podcaster, Chris Freeman. Chris, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hey, everybody.
And we've also got podcast Frontside favorite, Robert DeLuca.
Favorite? I don't know if you say that. Hey, everyone. How you doing?
I'm really excited about our guest today. Yehuda was just in Austin a couple of days ago. He gave a great meetup talk and a deep dive into Ember. And it looks like you're going on tour with that talk, Yehuda. Is that what I saw from your website schedule?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure exactly. I change it up every time, largely because things happen. So if I say this thing is, you know, active or in progress and then it actually ships, I have to change it up. But yeah, I've been talking a little bit about what's up, what we've been working on.
Do you want to give us a brief outline as to what's going on in that talk for those podcast listeners who might not be able to attend? What's going on with Ember? What's new? What is it that you're trying to get across here?
Sure. So actually, the talk I gave in Austin was, you're right, it was basically a deep dive. It was really focusing on a few targeted things that we're working on. I would say that at a high level, we're basically working on a couple of things. One of them is generally more integration with the ecosystem. That's things like ES6 modules, classes, components that look more like HTML, angle bracket components, things like that. So also improving Ember CLI so it's more integrated with other tools that people are using. A lot of that stuff has to do with the fact that Ember started a long time ago now, like 5 years ago or so. And so I think we've actually done a pretty good job of keeping up with things. For example, we adopted ES6 modules and promises a while ago now, and I think generally speaking, we tend to keep up to date with the ecosystem. But because we've been around for so long, there are certain things that, like classes, where it took a while for that feature to catch up with the kind of functionality that we were using in Ember. So decorators landed a little while ago as a stage 2 feature in TC39, and that lets us really take a bigger chunk of the functionality that we have in our class model and make it work for everybody with class syntax. And that's something we're pretty excited about. So that's one area, just generally taking things where Ember had its own stuff and try to integrate it better with the ecosystem. And another big area is just mobile readiness. And that also, a lot of that has to do with the fact that things like Service Worker have just recently landed. So for example, App Cache was a nice feature. It's in some ways, some people at Google will kill me for using the word nice and App Cache in the same sentence. But App Cache was trying to accomplish something for a long time. I think it did some version of what it was trying to do. But really, using App Cache as a default behavior for all users had just too many caveats to make it work well. Where Service Worker, because it's more low-level and more directly controllable, is a better fit for something that we could ship with all Ember users. So, you know, we basically want to have you use Ember and Ember CLI, you build an application, you get a good mobile experience out of the box. And some of that has to do with trimming down parts of Ember that we don't need to be using in simple applications. Some of it has to do with Service Worker. Some of it has to do with things like Glimmer 2, just making the performance better. But generally, that's the other category. So it's basically mobile readiness on the one hand and just integrating better with the wider ecosystem are both big picture things we're working on.
Something that you brought up in your talk were private Ember methods, and how a lot of people use private methods and you have to keep them around. And what you were just talking about, that was unifying around the conventions of programming in Ember. Whatever JavaScript people bring into Ember, you want to try to incorporate that as the language moves forward, which is, I think, a really interesting problem. And I was hoping you could talk on that a little bit further, is what do you look for in the way people use Ember going forward and how you have to kind of bend the framework to allow it to be backwards compatible? I'm curious what that decision-making is like.
What you're talking about and what I talked about yesterday is what we call intimate APIs, quote-unquote, and that basically means APIs that we never intended to be public, but for some reason or other, people got their hands on them and started using them, and I gave a somewhat elaborate example of such a case yesterday. But basically, the way we approach generally dealing with compatibility is pretty similar to how the web itself does it. So first off, there's a thing that we mark as a public API. We just don't break it unless we make a major version bump, which is very rare. We've had basically one of those in the entire history of Ember, and I don't think there's anyone coming in the near future. So one option is if we don't like something, we just break it, but that's very uncommon. Another option, and this is way more common, is that we try to build, and this for public APIs, We try to build a new API, and we try to nudge people away from the old one. So one approach for nudging that is probably the most common is deprecation. So deprecations themselves don't violate semantic versioning because we're allowed, you know, we can say, please don't use this anymore, just fine. The one area that's annoying about deprecations is that the code that powers the old feature has to still stick around. And so something that we've been working on around that aspect, around deprecations, is something we call Svelte builds, which is basically the idea that we'll mark every deprecation with the version that it started to be deprecated in, and what people can ask for, please don't include any code that was deprecated as of 2.4, 2.5, or 2.6, or whatever. And we'll automatically slurp it away. You could think of it sort of as like a reverse feature flag.
Wow, that's actually super interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so we haven't finished it up yet, but the RFC that talked about it is actually somewhat old now. I actually wrote the RFC along with 1.13 when I noticed that it was that 2.0 was going to end up being a pretty painful release for a lot of users. So we did a lot of things around 2.0 to make things less painful. Like we made sure that 1.13 contained all the deprecations that you could possibly need, as well as all the new features. So if you went to 1.13, you could look at all the deprecation warnings, switch to the new functionality. As long as you had no deprecations left, 2.0 was just the exact same code without any of the deprecated features. But as we were working on that, I realized that there's no real reason to give people such a hard break if we could instead just slurp away the code. So that's one approach, and I think more or less deprecations and then eventually Svelte builds are the normal path. With regard to intimate APIs, those are cases where, you know, people came to rely on very specific timing or very specific API, the very specific details of some internal API. And for those things, if we know that a lot of people use them, usually they get used through like a couple of add-ons, right? So, you know, like maybe Wormhole, Ember Wormhole, which is really popular, will use it. And then it's really hard for us to remove those things. Usually what we do is, those APIs are harder to maintain compatibility for because the exact details of what they even did was never really well-defined in the first place because they were never documented, right? So, usually what we'll do is we'll look at the usage of the API, we'll come up with a new API that is satisfying the exact same use case, and then we'll deprecate the old API. The policy these days is that you have to go through an LTS release, so we'll make sure to deprecate it. Let's say we want to deprecate something now, make sure to deprecate it in 2.8, and you'll note that here we're actually doing a whole song and dance to deprecate what is intrinsically a private API, so it would be within our rights to say, like, sorry guys, you use the private API, we're not going to help you, but we really think it's important that for Ember, if something feels like a breaking change, that we're not doing it willy-nilly. So if somebody upgrades to 2.9 and all of a sudden Wormhole stops working, they're not going to understand that the reason that happened was because Wormhole did a bad thing, right? So we basically need to do a bigger pass. So, you know, we'll do a deprecation in an LTS release, and then we'll wait a couple of releases before removing it. And then usually what happens is, in the meantime, we'll go ahead and we'll submit pull requests to the big add-ons that were responsible for it. And we'll also try to write down why it happened. So historically, we've done that a few times and it's worked okay. There was an example of this, which is the Factory 4 lookup factory API in Ember, which is really a boring API, but it's used a bunch by a bunch of high profile add-ons. And so the reasons why we needed to deprecate it were silly. They were just a bunch of bad behavior in the old thing that was making everything super slow. We can make things faster by giving people exactly the same functionality without exactly identical guarantees, right? So there were some quote-unquote guarantees which don't even make sense for private API. But there were some things that, in theory, the API did that we didn't want to support because of performance reasons. And so we gave people a new API that is, for all intents and purposes, identical. All users will be able to use it in an identical way, but it doesn't have exactly the same weirdness, and that weirdness was pretty expensive.
So you've trained Ember developers to be on the 6-week release cycle. They're looking at the blog post, they're looking to upgrade, but you've been involved in a lot of open source projects where I'm sure that wasn't really the case. Say jQuery has a huge API, and obviously some things have to be deprecated on that. And you were on the jQuery core team, I should mention.
Rails is the same story, right? It's a huge API, releases every year, more or less.
So I was just curious, the fact that you have Ember developers, I would like to think, hinging on your word and hinging on those updates, how would you go about, say, the Rails API or the jQuery API? Or maybe now you're involved with Rust, and maybe the plan is to have Rust on a 6-week release cycle. I'm curious, if you don't have your developers' attention as you do the Ember developers, how do you deprecate an API like that?
That's a good question. Like, how do you deal with deprecations if you're releasing quickly? So I think there's a couple of important points to make here. So first of all, Rust is on the 6-week release cycle and sometimes has the same kind of story with intimate APIs, although it's much less common with a strong type system like Rust. I guess important things to point out, first of all, deprecations don't intrinsically break things. So we're really only, when we talk about intimate APIs and deprecations happening pretty quickly, those are APIs that are large. If somebody's not paying super attention to Ember, they're probably not using those APIs. Like they would not have known to use them in the first place. They might be using an add-on that uses those APIs, and the intimate API deprecation process causes the add-ons to update relatively quickly. In terms of regular deprecations, those deprecations stick around forever. So you could come back a year later. For the most part, you can take an app that was 2.2 and upgrade it to 2.9 as long as you upgrade the add-ons that you're using at the same time, and everything will work. But we also realize that some people can't upgrade every 6 weeks, and that LTS release process, which is basically a 6-month process, more or less, it basically gives us a communication channel to people who want to pay less attention. So the way that works is that every 4 release cycles, so that's 6 times 4 is 24 weeks, so about half a year. Every 24 weeks, there's another release. Those releases, we assume people are on that release channel. So some people upgrade 2.4, 2.5, 2.6, 2.7, 2.8. Some people go directly from 2.4 to 2.8. For those users, we basically tell the add-on ecosystem, please make sure you support the last LTS release, which means that if you're a user who's on 2.4 and 2.8 comes around, you know that you could have stuck to 2.4 and generally gotten add-on support, but when 2.8 comes around, you should probably upgrade. And also with intimate APIs, we make sure we always deprecate them one LTS release before they're removed in an LTS release. Now, what that means is that if we want to remove something by the 2.8 LTS, we have to have already deprecated it in 2.4. If we want to remove something by 2.12, we have to remove it in 2.8. So 6 months is still not quite the 1-year Rails release cycle, but it's starting to get to a reasonable state. Also, I would point out that the LTS releases, the support policy for them is that they're 4 cycles long. We do bug fix support for 6 cycles and security releases for 10. What that means is that we're actually supporting LTS releases. We're supporting 2 at a time for security patches, 2.5 basically, and we're supporting like 1.5 at a time for regular bug, for critical bug fixes. And the 1.5 basically means that when 2.8 comes out, you have 2 release cycles, which is basically 3 months to upgrade. So if you're on 2.4 and 2.8 comes out, it's not like, oh my God, panic, I gotta upgrade right now. You can take a few months to upgrade. Basically, 2.4 came out, you got all the deprecations you need to care about, you had 6 months to deal with deprecations, and then another 3 months after that. So even in terms of intimate APIs, where in principle we, like Rails and jQuery, don't even care about those things for the most part. jQuery cares about it more. But most projects look at private APIs and say, sorry, I used a private API, why did you do that? Ember is a rare project in that we actually deprecate things that we know are actually used, and we have a process for dealing with them. And even that process, like I said, it's not a 6-week process. We don't deprecate something and remove it. We deprecate something and then give it a pretty long horizon before removing it.
So I'm curious, you brought up that you are the common element between jQuery and Rails and Rust. And I know that there are, at least between Rust and Ember, and from Rails to Ember, there have been a lot of commonalities and lessons learned in how the projects themselves are managed. But I'm also curious, with Rails, Ember is clearly pretty heavily influenced by Rails, which you were doing before, and you've been working on Rust quite a bit. And I'm curious, does your usage of Rust, even though it's a very low-level language, does that influence Ember at all? Has that changed how you think about the framework or JavaScript in general?
So I would say the most obvious, like the number one thing that I got out of all those projects that I think continues to be a thing is something like the convention over configuration idea, which is really not, I think convention over configuration is probably not even the best description of what it is. I think the idea that communities that are all working together on the same thing to build that thing better and better and better and build ecosystems around that thing, those communities are able to build much higher than communities that ask every single developer to put together a bunch of pieces themselves per project. That's the basic idea. And if you look at Rust, which is conceptually very low level, you'll find that there are things like Cargo, which is a tool that not only builds your thing, or not only is a package manager, but it has a convention for, not only convention, it has a built-in support for documentation. So you run Cargo Docs, you get all your documentation for all your dependencies. You run Cargo Bench, that's a built-in thing that runs your benchmarks. You run Cargo Test, that runs your tests. If you mark your documentation as being Rust code, it will automatically run your tests for you when you run Cargo Tests. It will build your examples for you and make sure your examples keep compiling. Right, so there's all this stuff in Cargo that you would not necessarily consider, like, it's basic workflow stuff. It's helping you get your workflow sane. Then there's things like Rust format, which we've been working on, and there's been a huge debate in the community about exactly how much configuration we want to allow in Rust format. But the higher order bit, and something most people agree with, is that we should try to come up with some kind of default style for Rust that everyone agrees to, that most people can pick up and use, and the Rust project itself will use. Right. And then there's things like futures and async.io, where the goal of those libraries is really to make there be a single central way that everybody does asynchronous IO in Rust. And these are all things that if you look at like C or C++, which are languages that are sort of in the same low level in this space, in the same kind of area, you'll find that those languages have billions of ways of doing all those things. And there's, you know, so many different style guides, so many different workflow tools, so many different things. You know, there's make and then a million things that replace make. Even though Rust is conceptually low level, the low levelness doesn't really affect every single environment has some set of things that everyone doesn't need to do themselves. And I think an important thing that people don't always get about convention and configuration is that it's not just that everybody doesn't have to do those things and it saves you some time. It's that when everyone's doing the same thing, it's a lot easier to build another level on top of it. So, for example, Fastboot is a great example of this in Ember. The fact that everyone initializes their application using an Ember initializer, the fact that services, which are these global things that are sort of global, there's no better word than services, but global services that different components can share, the fact that those are all going the same place, the fact that the way you manipulate DOM is always in a constrained single area, right? All those things mean that when it comes time to build something like Fastboot, it's pretty easy to take almost any Ember application and make it run in the Fastboot environment because we know what we're looking at. And that's something that isn't necessarily true about other tools. For me, Chris, the number one thing that I think all those tools share, including jQuery, actually. Like jQuery said, there's so many different ways that people do DOM manipulation. Why don't we unify it into one thing that everyone can use? And the, you know, the quote-unquote jQuery plugin, which is something that has fallen out of favor over time. The reason it was so popular was largely because people knew, okay, I'm dealing with a jQuery object. If I just put a plugin onto that jQuery object, it makes sense. People understand how to use it. And I think that's something that a lot of projects that I use share, and it's also something that is not nearly, it's not close to ubiquitous. It's very uncommon, actually. So that's one thing, the convention configuration story. I think another major aspect of all this is, and this is something that jQuery and Rails do not share, but Rust and Ember have the RFC process, which more or less is just a way of us as a community saying that the way that we agree to add new features to the project is not somebody coming down the mountain with a tablet every year at a conference saying we have agreed to add these features, but rather people, and sometimes these people are core team people, but sometimes they're not, sometimes they're active contributors, come up with an idea, write the idea down in a format that we all know how to deal with, and then there's a community discussion about it. Eventually sometimes it takes a very long time, sometimes not, but then we eventually come to a conclusion about what it is that we're doing. Eventually the core team agrees to merge the RFC. And really, I think one of the nicest things about the RFC process is that it produces an artifact that you can come back to a year, 2 years, 3 years later if you say, oh, I wonder why they made that decision. I wonder why that's the thing that they did. And the reason why this is great is that it actually, the RFCs are not gospel. They're not something that we should hold on to forever. But at the same time, we don't want to be relitigating things that we already discussed in depth over and over and over again. So if a person comes back and they say, oh, why did they do that? Why did they, you know, the module unification RFC, why did they structure directories like that? If they go back and look at the RFC and the thread associated with it, and the thing that they want to bring up is something that was already discussed, there's really no reason to bring it up again. But maybe someone thought of a different idea or a different reason to dislike or to disagree with the decision that was already made that wasn't already discussed. That's a much better rationale for bringing up, for relitigating. So in other words, relitigating is actually good, but if you're relitigating 5 times a day every decision, that doesn't let you move. So RFCs, by their very nature, the fact that the core team is doing things in public like anybody else, and everybody else is also participating in that same process, the fact that that artifact tells you more or less exactly what was discussed makes it really easy to decide when is a good time to revisit some questions.
Do you find that pull requests have the same process as an RFC in that it's an artifact you can go back to? It's a place to have communication that is visible to everybody, unlike, say, this micro message service such as Slack, right, where context is just lost for the public. So I'm curious if you want to see that modeled in pull requests or if an RFC is where something like that belongs.
I think pull requests are great. I remember back when I'm like the first user on GitHub who's not a founder of GitHub. I remember one of the things that excited me about GitHub early, although the very beginning didn't have pull requests yet. But one thing that excited me about pull requests is that before pull requests, every single time I would use a issue tracker, so there were like a billion issue trackers, like Lighthouse, whatever. And I was always like, I really want what I at the time called patch management, quote unquote. I want something that helps you manage patches, because the actual discussions are not the higher order bit. The higher order bit is this: someone has submitted a request for me to merge in this patch. How do I merge it? How do I discuss it with them, etc.? And those things were always really hard. So on Lighthouse, people would like upload patch files or whatever. It's hard to remember how bad things were, but this was for me the number one thing that was just so obvious, but also so terrible about the ecosystem before GitHub was patches were like the old Git mailbox approach, right? You would make a patch and hopefully get it to the right place at the right time. So I think pull requests and comments on pull requests and many of the improvements that have been made to pull requests are great. The reason I think RFCs are really important in addition to pull requests is that by the time someone actually took the time to write some code and submit it, it's very easy to look at it and say, well, I don't necessarily agree with all the things here, but I don't want to give this person a hard time. They already did the work. Whereas if somebody submits some idea early on and they say, you know, I have this idea, it's actually a lot easier to sort of get into the details at that point and say, oh, I don't, you know, don't do this. Maybe we should do this. Or it doesn't fit that well in with this other RFC or this other pull request that's already open. But once somebody actually does start actively working on a feature, I think pull requests are great. Like most open source projects these days, Ember doesn't ever commit anything to master. Everything goes through pull requests, even core team stuff. And I also find that when I submit a pull request or anybody on the core team, there are almost always people who are not on the core team that say useful things in the pull request for various reasons. Of course, pull requests also are the usual mechanism by which people run things like CI and linting tools and things like that, code quality tools. I think the pull request workflow is really good. In terms of other messaging services, I think there's just sometimes a need to have conversations that are faster than a pull request, and I don't really have any problem with chat conversations. But I definitely agree that if there's a deep conversation, this is something that happens in the Rust community a lot, where we'll be having this conversation with the core team and somebody will say, like, we should really move this out into a public discussion or move it into an RFC, or you don't agree with this thing that somebody said in public, can you just say your response in public? So I totally agree that if there's a thing that people want to say in private about something, but it's just in private for convenience, it's not private or transient for any good reason, actually getting out there onto the issue or the pull request and saying your opinion and letting the back and forth happen there is, for the exact same reason as you said, very useful. And in fact, Aaron Turan from Rust brings this point up repeatedly. We just had a conversation this past week, in fact, about the fact that we have sort of a norm in the Rust project that if we're saying something to the core team and it's just a technical topic that there's a core team room, right? We're saying it in the core team room and it's a technical topic, doesn't have anything sensitive about it. People always say, like, hey, can you move that into Rust internals, which is a public room? Or like move it in, there's a discourse, we have internals at rustlang.org, and I keep thinking Ember could use it. Basically, there's sort of a hierarchy of private to public but transient to like sort of a freeform discussion forum like discourse to something like a GitHub issue, something like an RFC to something like a pull request. And there's like a hierarchy of how much those artifacts are easy to search and find. But I think you're totally right that there's no reason why things like the core team need to exist, because at some point the buck has to stop somewhere. Somebody has to make decisions. Somebody has to actually be responsible for laying out the cross-cutting vision for the entire project. But those things are actually pretty lightweight. They more or less come from community discussions. They come from the core team when it's doing its job is just sort of making an omnibus of everything that the community is thinking at a particular point and making it more concrete. And so while I think that it's important that there are spaces which are core team spaces or spaces that are transient, I think a lot of questions that people have in the Ember Slacks are important that people can just jump in and ask them. I think getting things out into both public and more permanent artifact spaces is good.
Rob, you are a co-runner of Ember ATX, and I was hoping you could speak on the fact that we've gotten some core team members down to Texas to come talk. And it's nice that they're able to share their message with what's going on in the core team, but also they're doing work. They're seeing how real people use Ember and then taking that back to the core team. I was wondering if you had just would comment on that and your work on bringing some really excellent people who make decisions down to Austin.
As a meetup runner, like co-runner, I guess, so it's me, Jeff, and Lydia that run Austin Ember ATX. We really like to try bring people that are deep into Ember's core into Austin to talk about the framework that these people, I mean, work in daily. It's always awesome because, like, whenever you get them there in the flesh, you can ask questions, and it's, I guess we can go back to, like, where, you know, where Slack is. Like, you have that higher bandwidth communication, but it's even higher bandwidth when you're in person, and getting those people to talk to people that are actually, you know, working on the framework daily is, I think, hugely important. And that's why we work really hard to try and bring out people that, you know, work on the core.
For what it's worth, a thing that Rails and Ember shares in common, like as a core value, like other projects have more or less, is Ember core team people almost exclusively actually work on Ember apps as part of their job. So I work on Skylight. Having some responsibility in the real world for apps that you're working on makes a big difference in just feeling pain. I definitely noticed sometimes I'll be working on a project for a while. Like I was working on Rails for like 18 months and never actually used Rails. I used it, but not for anything significant during that time. And I sometimes get into a rut where I'm working on Ember a lot and haven't had a chance to work on an app at all. And then you go back and work on an app for like a day. And it's like, oh my God, there's so many obvious things that I can make better here, right? The kind of things that you think about when you're working on framework stuff is not necessarily the quickest hits, right? The quickest things that you could fix. Like the Ember welcome page is a good example of this, right? Like I think when someone's training, it's very easy for them to notice that it would be great if there was some kind of welcome screen for people, but it's not something that as a framework author you would necessarily think of on your own. So similarly, getting down to places that are not my usual haunts and hearing people bring up stuff that I just hadn't heard before, like things that I think, oh, that's a good idea, but I hadn't heard that. And a lot of that just comes from the fact, so the core team is pretty, has a lot of different kinds of users in it. So, you know, there are people doing training, there are people doing apps, there are people doing consulting, there are people doing rescue projects, right? And that kind of combo is pretty good. There's a long tail of all kinds of stuff, like people doing using WebSockets with Ember, people using React, people trying to do, you know, Redux in Ember. Who knows, right? And that long tail, it's impossible to represent all that long tail in the core team. We try to get as much of it as possible. It's impossible to represent the whole thing. So going out there and talking to people doing weird stuff, and weird is not meant pejoratively, just unusual stuff. And like Ember really wants to be pretty flexible under the hood, even though it's a pretty conventional tool, we want to be flexible under the hood. So I kind of know where the flexibility is, but sometimes I'll talk to somebody and I'll be like, oh, in retrospect, that particular thing that I thought was flexible is missing this little knob that we can add. So I really enjoy it.
Since you've been pretty heads down on Glimmer 2 and you are actually traveling out and talking to people, I'm curious, are you noticing any common themes from the feedback that you're getting recently in terms of what users are saying? Do you have an indication of like what the next move might be or what people are asking for?
For Glimmer specifically?
For Ember in general or Glimmer specifically, but I imagine you're probably getting general Ember feedback.
Yeah, so I talked about this a little before, like the two big areas of interest are mobile readiness and better integration with the ecosystem. Integration is the wrong word. There's nothing wrong with Ember.apps.extend, but people want classes. So I think those are the things, are the like the biggest picture things. I've actually noticed a couple like somewhat interesting things when working with Ember. So we shipped the Glimmer beta 6 weeks ago, and we're doing another beta just because there's a couple of bugs that we got that were tricky and we want to make sure we get right. I've actually noticed that people have... So on the one hand, the story of Glimmer is that we're pretty similar to React in the sense that you should think of what we're doing as a top-down re-render the whole time, and that there's some nice escape valve. So if you use Ember.set or the set API, then we are able to do what people do with show component update automatically for you, right? So if you use set, then we know, this whole area doesn't need anything to be updated. And if you think about it that way, if you think about it as like top-down re-render plus some nice wins around set, I think you'll notice that Glimmer's updates are always faster than React's updates. But people have come to really rely on the sort of quasi-guarantee that if you didn't update something, it doesn't change the DOM associated with it or even execute code associated with it. I find it sort of interesting. This is sort of like a meta problem, which is React actually got some things right about how to make this story performant. And part of that has to do with not assuming that you need as much bookkeeping as Ember always assumed that you need. And in exchange, you get much faster initial render and you have to do more work around updates. And we actually have a pretty good story here. Ember.set is pretty nice because it lets us use an API that our users are used to generate the should component updates for you. And that's nice. But people get very upset when things run that they didn't expect, which, of course, this is not how React people think about it, right? The way React people think about it is, oh, of course it ran. That's the API. It runs until you tell it not to. And Ember, if things run that people don't expect, they get very angry. So I think in terms of like the low, you asked me what I'm thinking about, and that's a low-level answer. But in terms of low-level, like thinking about how to shift the mental model of an Ember user so that we can get away with even like less and less bookkeeping upfront. Like we still do too much bookkeeping as part of initial render, but in order to keep reducing the amount of bookkeeping, we need people to get into a mindset of things are fast initially and the trade-off is that your updates are slower unless you do whatever. And there might be things like React has this wasted time debugging tool where they basically tell you, hey, you didn't tell us not to render this, but it never rendered, so you should try to do that. To be honest, I think having to write something like should component update that exact API manually is not okay. I'm not willing to do that. But there are a lot of things that approximate that or are similar, more similar to Ember's existing APIs that we can find. And I guess my medium-term goal here is to make it so that we have a sweet spot of trade-off here so that the initial render is always very efficient. I think we're getting closer. There's still some bad problems that we can deal with. So initial render is very efficient. Fast components are fast. And more or less, you get good updating performance until you reach a certain amount of scale, and then the escape valves are much nicer than should component update. They're basically little tags where you say, like, you know, this thing can't change, or it'd be hard for me to explain. It would be like its own meetup talk, but we've had a bunch of discussions about different escape valves, and the thing I'm most interested in is finding ones that feel semantic. Should component update doesn't feel like you're describing anything other than React's API, and I'm more interested in things that feel like you're talking about your app or your data.
Yeah.
Keeping with the Glimmer 2 topic, so Glimmer 2 is written in TypeScript, right?
Yeah.
Do you see that creeping its way more into the Ember community, or I guess I kind of just want to get your general thoughts on TypeScript and what your experience was writing in Glimmer 2.
I actually really like that. The story with TypeScript was that I was writing the Glimmer 2 originally in regular JavaScript, and I came back from a long trip, and I wanted to show Godfrey what I had done. And I was having trouble explaining some of the interfaces, and I was like, oh, I happen to know that TypeScript allows you to express interfaces, so I'll just use their syntax. And I think I opened the playground, and I typed in some TypeScript interfaces. And then I was like, oh, it's annoying that if I reload, I lose it, so let me copy the interfaces into, like, the README, basically, into the app. And then over time, like, not very much time, I was like, oh, it's very annoying that now that I have this, I really wish I could just use it inside of the code. And so we started doing that. It took us, like, maybe a week of yak shaving to be able to use TypeScript for real. But it wasn't, honestly, the code base was pretty big at that point, and the yak shave was not so bad. A lot of the reason why was at the time TypeScript's, like VS Code and TypeScript were still younger and it wasn't as slam dunk. Like, for example, in today's TypeScript, you can just have JavaScript files in your directory and just tell it to include them. That works. At the time, you couldn't, so you had to really change all the files. And there are some things, like TypeScript requires you to specify in classes. It requires you to specify all your fields. And I think that's fine. That's good for TypeScript. But you're not going to have already done that in JavaScript. So you can't just like rename all your JS files to TS and have a nice day. So it took us like a little under a week, I think. And we also had to write the broccoli TypeScript thing during that same period of time. Right? So that was another thing we had to do. Yak shave.
Yeah, that's a yak shave.
We had... And then like TypeScript changed the compiler API a few times. So we had a bunch of yak shaving to do. But... other than that initial like blob of yak shaving to get it working, I would say that it was every single point in time, it was always a strict win in terms of what we had to do to make TypeScript happy and what wins that we got out of it. So we got things like, obviously people know about code completion. I personally like code completion. I think it's helpful, but I think jump to definition is actually a more important feature than code completion. Just like, what is this method? I want to look at it. You can jump directly to it. Also, a thing for me, the code completion of parameters is way more important than the code completion of method names. So when someone teaches you about code completion, they'll usually show you, oh, look, you hit tab and it gives you a list of all the method names. And you're like, well, that's fine, but I probably know those method names. But you don't necessarily know all the parameters. And especially once you start using types, the parameter information is actually quite rich. Like it's telling you, you know, this is a component definition, this is a string, this is a whatever. So all that stuff, I think I basically have come to realize from using TypeScript that Microsoft has done a really good job with Visual Studio Code of distilling down just what part of IDE experience is really good and just bringing that to an editor that feels a lot like Atom or Sublime other than that. So you get like a pretty good IDE experience without all the bloat of like IntelliJ or Visual Studio.
I've seen some talk on GitHub about people who want to write their Ember add-ons in TypeScript. And I did not know Glimmer 2 was written in TypeScript until just now. So I'm glad that was brought up. But we as Ember developers have been trained to use convention over configuration. So the convention is Ember is not written in TypeScript, right? You're starting to see a convention now where logic has crept into the template. Or it's not as much a convention as people are doing it right now. I'm curious what your thoughts are to that, and more is treating handlebars as a programming language. It's something that we're seeing now in real production Ember code. So what is the path going forward there? Because it is happening.
Yeah, I agree. So I just want to say I didn't actually answer the previous question in full. I think my expectation is we have no interest in ever making TypeScript a mandatory part of Ember. I think Ember should always work and work nicely with regular JavaScript. I don't want to do anything that would lean too heavily on people having TypeScript around. Certainly, I don't want to do what Angular did, which is to use the types as semantic markers for dependency injection or anything like that. But I do anticipate things like Ember Metal, for sure, Ember Runtime being written in TypeScript, just because anything that's super, like pretty low level and a lot of algorithms benefits a lot from clearly delineating interfaces. So I think another thing people don't realize is that there are all these nascent interfaces floating around your code in JavaScript, but unlike, like if you write a class, it's pretty easy to document what the class does. But if you have an interface, there's not really any good mechanism for describing it, and it can become very nascent. It's like, please give me an object that has these three methods on it, and those three methods have... It's funny because you don't realize until you start using TypeScript that it's a very recursive problem, right? So it's like, it has these three methods on it, these three methods have these six parameters, and these parameters have these interfaces, and those have these, right? So you can actually start describing a very complicated thing, and it's not like those complicated things didn't exist before. They were just very implicit. And the explicitness of the interfaces is not, you can like write it very tersely, right? You can write the three interfaces and have the methods with all the types, and then that works fine. So I think I expect Ember Metal, Ember Runtime, other low-level parts of Ember. Certainly the component library now is like directly linking in with Glimmer, and Glimmer is written in TypeScript, so that stuff would really benefit from TypeScript. I think that's very likely. In terms of Ember itself using TypeScript, I think we have sort of a medium-term goal of letting Ember apps use TypeScript if they want. I would say that making that store really nice pretty much leans on ES6 modules and ES6 classes. So we have a sort of some ES6 modules, but there's still a lot of like Ember dot whatever in our module story. And in terms of classes, we're still using the old style class system, and that class system is actually just really hard to get the types working in TypeScript. It's hard, period, but like React has a similar problem, and there's a lot of advanced features in Flow that only really exist to enable you to express ES5 class complexity, and TypeScript doesn't have all those features. So my expectation is that sort of along the same path as getting ES6 classes, we will also get TypeScript support in Ember, and I think a lot of people are interested. A lot of people have worked on Glimmer now and are like, I would love to do this in my app, and so we'll probably have that happen. Coding your templates was the other question. So I sort of have a mixed feeling about this because on the one hand, I actually do want Glimmer to be a programming language in production way. I think something that templating engines, so either templating engines are just, they use the programming language embedded like by ERB, or they are like Mustache or like the Django templating engine. I forget what that thing is called. But there's a bunch of templating engines that use like the curly syntax, and those things aren't very rigorous in terms of how they think about scope. And like lexical scope turns out to be a pretty important thing about how programming languages work. If you have a shaky scope story, people don't have a good sense of what's going on. So like the Angular 1 templating story was you basically define your scope wherever and you attach it to a part of your template, And that basically means that if you're looking at just a template, you have no idea what the actual variables mean anyway. Because basically any part of it could be hooking up the scope to be whatever. And a big thing, so this is something that I started with Handlebars, but have refined a lot over time and I'm pretty happy with now. The Glimmer templating engine is basically defined as a programming language. It has scoping story when you have, if you want a variable name, it, you use the as pipe syntax and you get some variables there. Your function, your components and your helpers are functions. And sometimes those are written in JavaScript, just like in Ruby, some of your functions are written in C. But ultimately, just like a C extension can't magically change the scope of a Ruby program, a helper or component in Glimmer can't magically change the scope of your template. And all that means, if you look at a Glimmer template, it's actually really clear what all the names mean. That sounds boring, but ultimately, that's one of the things that makes you look at a lot of templating engines and not really know what's going on or how to understand what's going on without thinking a lot about what every single one of those custom helpers is doing, right? So that basically, if you look at, I think Jinja is the name of the templating engine in Django, yeah. So if you look at some of the templating engine like that, or even like Handlebars before Ember 2.0, you really have to know that like for X in Y is a magic syntax that means a particular thing. And because a lot of these templating engines are very flexible in the sense that they let users add whatever, any particular piece of syntax could actually be creating random names that mean whatever. So I've just found, having worked through that in the Ember community, I'm very happy that we took the time to get that stuff solid. One of the nice side effects of that is that it makes some of the usual optimizations that people do on code work very nicely, right? So once we know what all the names mean and what all the scopes mean, things like inlining, specialization for invocations, right? So, you know, this component is invoked here. It has these parameters, but those parameters are all strings, and I can see the receiving end just sticks those strings into attributes or something. So at compilation time, I can combine that all into one thing. This is an optimization that we haven't done yet, largely because we've been working on compatibility. But there's a lot of sort of normal, quote-unquote, programming language standard optimizations that we can do because we've designed Glimmer to be a programming language. So the fact that we've done that is actually the root cause of people doing more programming language stuff in their templates in older versions of Ember before we had done such a good job of rationalizing everything. You would start doing that stuff and you would start hitting cliffs where the behavior didn't work the way you expected for some reason. Like you would say with, and then you'd use a sub-expression as something, and then depending on exactly which things you put into the slots, maybe it didn't update on the inside of the template. And we always consider those things bugs, right? So we would fix the bugs if we encounter them. There's an explosion of different kinds of things in a programming language. And if you don't model variables as variables, basically, then it's hard to know, you know, callbacks to variables as variables. There's a lot of bugs. So people, they would start using the APIs as a programming language. They would hit some limits and they would pull back. But today, the implementation of Glimmer is, especially Glimmer 2, is extremely bog standard. And what that means is that if you want to do very nested parenthesized expressions with as pipe something, and then you want to go take that and send it into a component, and you have that, and you put that value, put it into a service, and you look, like you do all that, and it works. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good idea for your template to be a large program. That's generally bad. I think the main question that you're asking me. I think it's generally bad for things to get really complicated. But I think there is a reason for it, and I think there's something we're doing to make it better. So I think the reason for it is that the real escape valve, if you think about the Glimmer programming language, the main escape valve that you have to get complicated expressions out of Glimmer and back into a reasonable place is helpers, right? So let's say you have a big bunch of nested and/ors, whatever people are doing inside of their Glimmer templates, and it's like a multi-line thing, and you want to pull that out into a more reasonable place. And a natural way to do that is to make a helper. But it's pretty common that you have a complicated piece of expression but isn't reusable. It's not being reused in multiple places. And helpers in Ember right now are global. So you might have this big blob. And so you can make another escape valve is computed properties, but computed properties don't have the nice, like I have a few input parameters and I just do something. They always require that you're doing something against the component itself with this. And that isn't usually what you're doing, right? You usually have what is effectively a function with a bunch of parameters in it, and those parameters combine in some way, like with, you know, and, or maybe there's some comparisons like greater than, less than, whatever. One of the things that comes out of the module unification RSC, and makes everyone pretty excited is the ability to have helpers in your templates that are local. So it's a helper that is just sitting right next to your template. And I think those kinds of things, helpers that are right next to your template, will give people who like you, do not want to see so much code in your template, a much nicer story to explain to people who are doing it what they should do instead. If you look at a template and it has a 3-line, 15 parenthesis expression, and you want to convince the person not to do it, the refactor is literally just make a helper, a local helper, put the code in there and use the local helper. And I think that's just a better story to explain to people than, hey, I don't like that. It feels bad. And they're like, what should I do? I don't know.
So this brings up an interesting point that we actually encountered recently. At the front side, we use helpers a lot and are frequently trying to get them to do all sorts of weird things. But recently it occurred to us that one kind of blocker was that you can't compose helpers. We had an existing helper and we kind of needed to make a helper on top of it. And it suddenly dawned on all of us that, oh, like we can't go up a level. Like we can't build a helper that's an abstraction over another one because you kind of have this flat, like you have to hit the DOM. You have to have a component or a template or something to invoke that.
Is that true? I would expect that you could call the function with, the arguments might look ugly, but I would expect that you could call it and just pass the params and hashes, brackets, and
like a helper.invoke or something? Because if to write a new helper, you would have to go back to JavaScript.
The array and object. I would expect that to work. Do you just mean a helper calling another helper?
Well, a helper composing several helpers into a bigger helper and then just calling in the template. Much like how you might write some functions and then write a function that closes over them or something.
Like, are you talking about a helper that takes a helper?
I guess it could be. Higher order helpers could be a thing in this case.
So helpers that call helpers or helpers that close over helpers really should just... Helpers are more or less functions.
Yeah.
Should just be able to use them directly. I think what you're saying is an interesting Ember phenomenon, which I actually don't know which of two categories this discussion is in. Basically, either there is some good reason why this turns out to be difficult and there's like a missing API and we should fix it. Like in general, my mental model here is you're talking about a function. So if you can do something with function, it really should work. And if that is hard, there's something weird. Basically, what I'm saying is either there's some gotcha about how it's structured right now that's like an accident that makes them not exactly as much like functions as we think, or the mental model that you have using them doesn't make you think of them like functions. So you think that they're hard to compose, but actually they're functions. Basically, those two things are equally likely in Ember. Like, I think that's unfortunate.
I think that we found that you can certainly combine them like in a template, and you could even, you know, pass one into the other. Where we ran into an issue was similar to functions. If you are writing like an NPM library, you may write 5 functions and only export one of them. And that one function will compose the other 4 and call them. And in some cases, you may not realize you want to export that composed abstracted function until much later. And it's okay because you just, you know, import the function from somewhere else. And then you say like, all right, I'm just going to consume this function from another. And now I have this combination put together. Well, with a helper, if you already have a helper that does something and then you realize, oh, actually, I need to build an abstraction on top of this helper in a new helper. We so far have not found a good way to combine them like that.
So we probably will not succeed at having this conversation through to the completion here. I'll just say for listeners, what I find surprising about this, although I can believe that there is something that makes it true, is that helpers in Ember are really just functions. And increasingly, they really are. Like the helpers in Glimmer are functions. They have a weird argument signature. They take positional params as an array and named arguments as a dictionary. And that's just a convenience, basically, because otherwise you have to scrape off the last parameter and try to figure stuff out. So that's just a signature issue. But generally speaking, helpers are supposed to be functions. And if there's something that you could do with regular functions, you can't do them with helpers, that sounds to me like something is wrong. I can definitely believe, like, I should talk to Chris about this and he should write a blog post about it or something. I can definitely believe that there's something that makes this true, but it's hard for me to imagine what it is.
Well, I will gladly talk to you about it offline.
Yes, we will figure it out.
Yehuda, thank you for this deep dive into open source process, into Ember. I could drill deeper into your brain and just extract as much knowledge as I can. And I hope to be able to do that someday soon. We're going to wrap up for today. Thank you very much for Yehuda Katz and your time.
Yeah, thank you. I apologize for if people didn't understand half the things I said.
Yeah, it's a podcast for everybody, but we have a lot of Ember developers listening, and I'm sure that they loved it and ate it all up. So thank you very much.